So we are duly convened. Let me know if it's too loud or too soft, so that, because I can't hear what I'm broadcasting, but I assume it's okay unless you tell me differently.
Perfect.
I really hate the fact that I have to wear this mask, and I'm not sure I do, but at this point, I think it's probably the conservative thing to do for me. Let's make sure that everybody is duly signed in or registered. If you are registered, then you simply print your name on one of the two yellow sheets that say attendance. You need to do that every week. That's what pays adult ed. We submit that to the state, or report on that to the state, and they give us the money for the heads that are in the room. So please make sure you do that every week you come. If you haven't been in class before, you probably didn't get the email about 2 weeks ago saying, please register, a reminder to register. If you didn't get that email, we have to put your name on an email list. And we do that by your putting your email on the third yellow sheet that says, email only if. For people who aren't yet registered, you need to fill out a white registration form. They're sitting there. Fill it out fully and give it to me, and I submit it, and we get you registered. Those are some of the intricacies of this course. The fourth intricacy is the syllabus, which is sitting there, which you may take if you like. I would like it if you would file it in the circular file. I didn't write it, but it's there. So any question about procedural stuff, like registration, for signing in, remember to sign in.
Who wrote the syllabus?
What's that?
So who did write the syllabus?
I think Andy wrote part of it about 5 years ago. And it was what was politically correct at the time, but they didn't bother to pass it by me before they made it official in the state. All right, so welcome back. It's wonderful to see you. If you're new to this class, then you probably are in the wrong place, and you should definitely know. this class meanders all over the place, but the basic idea is we would like to become more conscious of what's going on inside us and what's going on around us. And we attempt to, week after week, explore those boundaries of evolving consciousness. Let's see what I have to announce. Yeah, just one announcement about something that's coming up. A week from tomorrow, Dave Cumes is doing a class called Gratitude and Happiness, Sources for Spiritual Transformation. Dave Cumes is really worth listening to. Many of you know that. He's come to class numerous times here. A week from Saturday, a week from tomorrow, he's teaching a class that you need to sign up for. It does cost money, but not a lot. Oh, cell phones. I guess that's please turn off your cell phones so that we don't have a constant symphony. All right, what are we going to do this morning? I don't know. No, we're okay, no. sort of. We're going to meditate. Please sign in. Oh, good. I'm glad you're here, Bob. You're going to be abused. By the way, hello, everybody. I can't say individually hello to everybody, but I see that everybody, that you're here, and I'm so glad to see you again. What we're going to do this morning is we're going to meditate for 10 minutes, as we typically do at the beginning of class. I'll talk about that in a little bit. And then I thought, because this class is called Consciousness, Science, and the Nature of Being, which was a title that I didn't exactly choose. It was what was politically correct enough. That was a long time ago. But I thought, since the title of the class is Consciousness, Science, and the Nature of Being, we at least ought to look at Consciousness, Science, and the Nature of Being a little bit. So I thought I would do that today. So we're going to kind of leave the mundane level today. And I get, what do they call those things before they tell you stuff? A disclaimer? You know, in the small print? There's a lot of small print here. I have no idea about half this stuff in terms of what I'm talking about, but I'm making the attempt anyway. So, apologies beforehand for the fact that this lecture is not going to be polished and may not even be right. If we have enough time, we're going to see one or even, I would like to see two videos this morning that support the lecture, but we may only have time to see one, in which case we'll see the second one next week. All right, meditation. In these 10 minutes, you can do anything you like that you consider to be meditative and helpful to you. If you're doing mindfulness, let me remind those of us who've been doing mindfulness for a very long time that it's really not very complicated. It's really about two things: opening up and paying attention. So if you do nothing else, and you probably should do nothing else if you're being mindful, just remember to let yourself soften and open at every level, physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. Just let yourself soften and open progressively. And as you do so, things will rise into your awareness. Notice what you're noticing, and notice that you're noticing. So what do you notice? You notice what's going on inside you, thoughts, feelings, and physical sensations, and you notice what's going on around you. And as you become more relaxed and more open, you notice more and more. And then you get sucked into something and you don't notice anything else but that. You don't even notice that. You're just absorbed in it. And then you remember to come back to being present and open. That's all we're learning to do. However, it's not trivial what we're learning to do, but it's very simple in that respect. So let's sit for 10 minutes, okay? How is this? Good volume? Good. All right, so I made some notes because I knew I was going to ramble all over the place, and I didn't want to kind of ramble off the road completely. So, there are, in my mind and in the mind of a lot of other people, three overriding unsolved problems in science. Those three problems are what the structure of the universe is. That is, what the building blocks of the universe are, and what's going to happen to the universe as those building blocks interact with one another. So this is the fundamental question of physics. What is this, and where is it going? Especially the fundamental question of subatomic physics and cosmology, the smallest and the largest. So that's the first of the great unsolved questions. By the way, hold your comments and questions till the end if you can, please, because I'm sure many of you are going to have much to say about this. There's a lot of expertise here. But we're going to be touching on so many things that just jot down what you want to say, okay? And then at the end we'll exchange. Okay, the first fundamental question is, what's the structure of the universe, and what's its fate? Second fundamental question, how did the non-living universe, this stuff, give birth to life? How did life arise out of non-life? And that's the fundamental question of biology, and especially of, and also of biochemistry, and especially of molecular biology. So how did life arise? And then there's a third fundamental question, which is how did this living matter give birth to consciousness? That is, how is it that we have an inner life? That's the fundamental question of psychology and neuroscience, and probably other disciplines also. And I think these three questions are intimately related. They're really subsets of one deeper question. And that deeper question is the nature of things. And let's explore the interrelationship of these three major scientific questions. So there are two basic views. What I'm going to tell you is not something you don't know. I'm just kind of put a lot of stuff together that you, I think most of us have thought about a lot. Okay? So there are two fundamental views of how these three areas, physics, biology, and psychology, are related. How physical reality, livingness, and consciousness are put together. View number one of the two views. Consciousness is primary. It's the thing that births the universe. Consciousness pre-exists the physical universe, and at some point, it issues forth the physical universe. This is the mystical worldview. And then after the physical universe is made existent from consciousness, then consciousness puts into the physical universe life. And that's God touching Adam, and life, the physical universe becomes alive. Okay. So it's something from outside the physical universe, from another dimension, that makes the physical universe come to life. So something is added to the physical universe. And that it what's added comes from a transcendent dimension, which made the physical universe and then is adding to the physical universe. In physics terms, people talk about this derisively as the secret sauce. There's something extra universal that has to be added to the universe in order for the universe to cook up life and then for life to cook up consciousness. I've heard Dan Siegel talk about this as capital M mind gives birth to brain, which gives birth to small M mind. And looked at that way, there's a unification of science and spirituality, in that science talks about brain and small M mind, and spirituality talks about capital M mind. Okay. All right, so view one is that it's the spiritual view, that consciousness is the basis of reality. Okay. View two, the so-called scientific view, which is that what's fundamental is the physical universe, this stuff. And a particular arrangement of the physical universe, when the stuff of the physical universe gets together in a certain way, life results. And then when life gets together in a certain way, consciousness results. So the physical universe is reality, is what's most real, and then the arrangement of physical reality creates life, and the arrangement of life creates consciousness. And that's the fundamental side, the orthodox scientific view. Spokespeople for that, we've listened to Max Tegmark talk. He certainly talks about this very lucidly. He says, you know, it's really inevitable that life is going to arise from physical reality, probably not only on this planet. You know, what we know is that life arose on this planet maybe 4 billion years ago, maybe once, maybe numerous times. But given this view, it's likely that there's life all over the place, because the physical universe will arrange itself in certain ways and life will result. So this second view, this orthodox scientific view, says that life and consciousness are emergent properties. They emerge naturally from the physical universe. They're something new that is evidenced, that comes naturally from the arrangement of the physical universe. They appear. But they don't appear from outside. They weren't put here from outside. They appear naturally from the nature of physical reality. Well, by the way, if already your eyes are crossing, next week we'll go back into psychology and touch the earth again a little bit better. But this is fun to do, I think, for most of us. This is stuff we think about. So I wrote here, by the way, some people these days are arguing that there's a consciousness that will arise naturally from the arrangement of physical stuff that doesn't involve life, and that consciousness is already being evolved. It's called artificial intelligence, AI. That is, if you put the stuff of physical reality together in a certain way, you will get a conscious machine that doesn't have to go through life to get to consciousness. And some people even think that that's the next step in evolution. That if what evolution is really about is more consciousness, then probably life is an intermediate stage of evolution. And that now that life has given birth to artificial intelligence, life is no longer needed, machines will just get smarter and smarter and smarter. All right, so view one, let's call it spirituality, just to review, says that consciousness gave birth to the universe. At least part of consciousness became the universe. So the universe is a part of consciousness. Consciousness is larger, universe smaller. View two, we'll call the scientific view, or at least the orthodox scientific view, says that the universe gave birth to consciousness. So at least part of the universe became conscious. So consciousness is a part of the universe. So they're opposite. One says that the universe is a part of consciousness. The other says that consciousness is a part of the universe. Okay? Confused so far? I hope not. I'm trying to be somewhat clear. But both of these fundamental points of view say that at this point the universe is conscious and alive, at least locally. That is, it's pretty clear that we're in the universe, we're alive, and we're conscious. So whatever, however it happened, at this point the universe is conscious and alive, at least around us. So this brings up the question, why did this happen? This life and this consciousness stuff. Why did the universe just stay a bunch of gas and dust? Why do we have life and consciousness? And what do I want to say to that? This may not be a valid question. This may not be a question that is worth asking or worth answering anyway, because it may be just a conceit of the human mind.
Yes.
That is, the human mind needs to try to understand things so it can predict things. What I want to know is why that happened so I can figure out what's going to happen next so I can survive. So that may be the way the human mind works, but it may not have anything to do with the way reality actually is. Okay. There may be no intention involved here. It may just be the way that it works, and nobody is trying to make it work a certain way. That may be just what the way we look at it to try to understand it. That doesn't mean we're not going to try to look at it to understand it. So I wrote here, in other words, we're projecting a why, an intention, onto a universe that doesn't have one. It's just doing whatever it does. I'm not saying that's true, I'm saying that's something we need to consider. Okay. So far this is the easy part, now we get to the more interesting part. So, arguing for the present, so there are arguments for both of these points of view, the mystical and the scientific and the orthodox scientific point of view. So let's look at some of these arguments. Arguing for the presence of a creative, guiding, transcendental force, some other dimension which is gave birth to this dimension or set of dimensions and is influencing it, okay. Some kind of spiritual influence. Okay. Arguing for this are, one, the profundity of human consciousness. That is, let's see if I can put these two together. I can't lick my fingers to get my piece of paper. Human consciousness realizes so incredibly much, it's so rich, that it's hard to believe that it happened by accident. Given our human understanding of the physical world and appreciation for it. So human consciousness seems to have a different flavor than anything else in the universe that we know about, in the physical world, I mean. Animals are conscious, and they have, clearly they have some consciousness, and plants have some consciousness. But human consciousness seems to have a different, It's different in kind and in degree. It's just more. It couldn't have a... Human consciousness is so extraordinary that it's highly unlikely that it arose accidentally. It seems like it was designed. Second argument for this transcendental dimension is the course of evolution. So when we look at evolution, it looks like, and again this may just be our mind projecting onto it, but it looks like there's an intention to evolution, a direction to evolution. Evolution is progressing, it's going somewhere, there's an arrow. And in human beings, evolution has, it's moved from simply being, bringing us a consciousness of us, a consciousness that enables us to survive, to a consciousness that appreciates life and thinks about and tries to understand life transcendentally. So, let me say it again, or say it better. You can look at consciousness as having evolved in nature to help creatures survive. So consciousness is a survival adaptation. But in human beings, consciousness is no longer just about survival. It's about appreciating the extraordinariness of being alive, and it's about musing about about things that we're talking about now that are possibly transcendental. So consciousness has taken on a different function or a different quality than simply the survival quality. It's as though human consciousness went this way. Here was the evolution of consciousness throughout the animal kingdom, and suddenly in human consciousness it went up like that. It went to an orthogonal dimension, a dimension that's at right angles to physical reality. It went like that. It's pointing somewhere beyond physical reality.
God,
well, that's actually perfect timing. Because what I wrote down here is, so when you think about human consciousness and the quality that human consciousness has evolved, think about heart. That is, why does every indigenous culture and every kid do art? It really, some of it, you know, you can look at art, you can trivialize art and say, well, people do art because they can make a living that way, you know. But kids don't do art because they can make a living that way, and indigenous cultures don't do it. We do art because there's something about that we want to celebrate, you know, that we want to better understand and better appreciate. And especially great art. It's really hard to believe that Beethoven wrote the Fifth Symphony purely, or the Ninth Symphony, purely because he wanted to make a living. You know? Not that there wasn't some of the motive or the kind of base motive, but what came out is something else. It's something that it indicates an ascension of consciousness. And look at science. You can argue that science is about helping us to survive better. We can understand the world better, we can predict it better, we can control it better, we can have the energy, we can, you know, do all the things that science does. But when you go to the frontiers of science, what you get is a lot of scientists going, oh my God, you know, it's so mind-blowing, we know so much more than we would need to know to put food on the table. And the reaction of people that know this stuff is, oh my God. And that makes a lot of scientists transcendental. Scientists have a spiritual feeling about things. I think Einstein said, I don't remember the exact quote, but it's about the mystery and how it's the unknown, the mysterious, is the source of all art and science. And those who don't taken by the mystery, they're as good as dead. Their eyes are closed. That was, pretty much the quote that he said. And Ken Wilber wrote a book called The All Mystics, I think was the name of the book, about these great 20th century physicists, all of whom said, oh my God, there must be something going on here because it just, it's too mind-blowing. So these are arguments for the fact that human consciousness is pointing in a direction, and that direction is a transcendental direction. It's a direction that leads beyond the physical world. You even see this in, this is where I'm going to get a little controversial. You even see this in evolution in animals and plants, not just human consciousness. Quite a while ago, I went to a dinner party where I was seated next to a biologist, I think an evolutionary biologist from UCSB. And I said, because I had the opportunity to sit next to an evolutionary biologist from UCSB, I said, it's kind of hard for me to believe that evolution kind of accidentally, no matter how many generations went by, got from lizard to bird. And, the conventional argument is that a random mutation happened, and one lizard was born with a little bit looser skin than the other lizards, and that lizard could jump a little bit further. And so that that mutation became dominant in the population. And then sometime later, there was another mutation, and another lizard had a little looser skin than that, and that lizard could jump further, and so that lizard's mutation became, and then mutation after mutation, you got different forelegs of the lizard, and you somehow got these looser skin to be feathers, And I said to him, doesn't it seem kind of unlikely, no matter how many generations, that you would go from looser skin to feathers? Doesn't it seem like there's some sort of intention there that is driving this? And he said, you just don't understand the law of large numbers. That was his quote. And I thought to myself, what an arrogant. He doesn't know who I am. He doesn't know my background. Want to know about large numbers? But when you look at evolution, now this may be just our projection, but it sure looks like nature is real smart, and it figured out stuff. Like plants figured in the desert, figured out how not to get eaten by animals by making spikes called needles on them, capturing them. And there are all sorts of species seem to be brilliant at finding out how to survive. Your dog. They figured out a long time ago that if they could cooperate with us and manipulate us, they would do very well, and they're doing very well. They even, I heard a National Geographic video maybe 10 years ago saying that dogs have figured out to look in your left eye selectively versus your right eye. Why? Because the left eye is connected to the right side of the brain, and so it shows emotion more quickly and more powerfully than the right side. You can do that. You put the mirror here and on your photograph, and you can see that your left side and your right side are different, and your left side is more emotionally labile, typically, than the right side. So dogs have figured out, look on the left side, you can find out what he's thinking or what she's thinking. Maybe that happened just by random chance, but it doesn't seem like it. So it seems like evolution is smart. And that smart comes from some intention. Something was created here that it was created intentionally for a purpose. Okay. Don't get it. Those of you who are in this don't get so smart, I'm going to knock it down, Neil. if I can. So let me get it back to four. Yeah. Okay, oh, there's one more. There's one more argument for why, for spirituality, or for a transcendent dimension. And that, I shouldn't say spirituality, because some of us are horizontally spiritual. We're spiritual because we feel connected to other people and to the whole planet, but we don't have a transcendent spirituality. So I should say transcendence. Okay, a third argument here is the very convincing nature of the spiritual / mystical experience that some of us have had. So people who have had these experiences throughout history, either by spontaneously having these experiences, or having these experiences in glorious places in nature, or having these experiences near death, or having these experiences with great sensory deprivation, or with a lot of physical suffering, or with starvation, or with psychedelics, they kind of talk in the same terms about the experience. And one of the things they say is, it's more real than this. You see that the usual consciousness we have is a reducing valve. It enables us to work in the world, but it doesn't show us all of reality. And when you have a mystical experience, you see it, this whole picture, and you see how we fit. The usual consciousness fits into this much larger picture. And it's extremely clear, and it's extremely convincing, and it answers the question. And so many people that are smart have said this throughout history that you can't kind of brush it away. You kind of got to take it seriously. The counter argument to that is, if you cut off sensory input into the mental processes gain a greater reality because they're not contrasted with sensory input. And also, if you throw stuff into your brain that creates more of certain neurotransmitters, then sure it's going to seem super real because you just put steroids in your brain, you know? Or things that are like steroids in your brain, they make your brain more. So it's not that these things that people are experiencing are really true, it's that they seem preternaturally true. But that's, that we can explain that physically. It's something that can be explained neurologically. Okay. So those are the three arguments. There are three of the arguments for a transcendent dimension. One is the profundity of human consciousness. Second is the course of evolution, the intentional course of evolution, or seemingly intentional course of evolution. And the third is the convincing nature of spiritual experience, mystical experience. Okay, arguing against the presence of something extra-universal, arguing for the orthodox scientific position, are, one, these are strong arguments. One, the fact that since science has arisen, you know, it was there a little bit earlier, but it really kind of kicked in the last 400 years. Okay. Since that has happened, human life has changed dramatically for the better. For many thousands of years, people kind of suffered and stumbled a bunch. There was progress, but it was still, the amount of progress was this much. Since science happened, the amount of progress is that much. You know, in 1903, the Wright brothers got off the ground for a couple of seconds on a bicycle. So that was 1903. In 1969, we were walking on the moon. I mean, things have been, human life has developed, has changed incredibly rapidly with the advent of science. So when spiritual, religious, transcendental ideas were the dominant story in human life, things kind of plodded along and didn't improve very much. Once the scientific story became the dominant story, human life took off. That's a pretty strong argument. Second argument, a against some kind of transcendental dimension. And this is a hard one for me to express well, but the idea that science can, the idea that science can explain spirituality much better than spirituality can explain science. That is, from a scientific point of view, people have to have these spiritual ideas, and they arise naturally in all cultures because people realize that they're mortal. And that's untenable. And so if you think, well, gee, I'm just going to be here for a little while, and then that's the end of the story, that's a bummer. It's much better to think, well, I'm going to be reborn, or there's going to be another dimension that I go to. It's a necessary human delusion from Orthodox scientists' point of view. We need to think this, but it's wrong. But it helps us to stay alive and to do okay in life. So we have to delude ourselves in this way, and the nature of the delusion is very similar in all cultures. That is, every culture, no matter what their spiritual system is, says, you don't really die. There's some continuance. And that's very comforting. Even if, from some Orthodox scientist's point of view, very wrong. So that's science explaining spirituality. But spirituality doesn't do a very good job explaining science. In fact, as far as I understand it, the only argument that spirituality makes or has made about science in the last 400 years or so is somehow there's something wrong with it. Like it's the devil's work somehow. It's taking us away from our spiritual roots, and it's secularizing us too much. It's a Faustian proposition, kind of, where science is somehow doing us wrong. And that's not a very convincing argument. So science explains spirituality as something the human mind has to do, wrong but necessary. Spirituality kind of doesn't explain why we have the James Webb Space Telescope. So, where am I with it? I'm getting to the end of this soliloquy, or that's a nice way to put it. This, what did Simon Garfunkel say? A desultory philippic? I looked up those words once. It meant you ramble around talking a lot about nonsense. Okay, from the Zen point of view, that's what I know more about. This would be a total nonsense.
Oh,
really? But fun, what? From the Zen point of view, this would be total nonsense. Okay, and from the Gestalt, from Fritz Perls' point of view, this would be elephant shit. All right, so where am I on all this? For many, many years, like a bunch of us, like a lot of us, I've had one foot in either camp. I'm really schooled in both of these ways of looking at the universe or at looking at reality, and they're both very compelling to me. They both seem like they have a lot of reality to them, and yet they are intellectually opposite. They can't both coexist. Either there is a transcendent dimension or there isn't a transcendent dimension. So I don't consider this like a Hegelian thing where thesis and antithesis, dialogue and then a synthesis comes. Maybe, I'm going to actually kind of hint at that in a little bit, but from my point of view, I don't know which one's real. It used to really bother me, like tear me apart a little bit. And now I'm just so used to having a left and a right side that it's kind of fun. And this class kind of bounces around between these two poles, you know. So I'm hoping that you can. Marion Woodman said, Marion Woodman's a Jungian analyst that some of you know about. Marion Woodman said, hold the tension of the opposites. That's what she said. It's just what you want to do with things that seemingly are irreconcilable is you just want to hold that tension. And somehow that helps. or that involves you. I'm waiting. All right, so this is where I get into the most trouble, but it's not a very long thing, I'm going to tell you, which is there is an emerging reconciliation of these two viewpoints, the mystical and the orthodox scientific, or the mystical, the spiritual and scientific. And that you see that reconciliation in modern physics. So classical physics says that the material universe is what's fundamental, what's real. That time and, this is classical physics up until the 20th century. Time and space are absolute. They exist everywhere the same way. And it doesn't matter if you're looking or not. It doesn't matter if you're on Venus or on Mars or on, you know, in China. Time and space are the same. Time and space are the framework of the universe. And they're the solid framework. It doesn't, you're gonna, if I measure a foot here, I can go anywhere else in the universe with my ruler and I can measure a foot. Time and space are the constants in the universe. That's classical physics. Quantum physics says, let's go to relativity, okay, first. Relativity, starting 1905 with Einstein and then 1916, I think, was the general theory, said, that's not true. How, the conditions of observation will determine how you see the universe. That is, time and space will be measured differently for different observers. Now, the example. So what's constant in the universe is the speed of information, the speed of light, the speed of electromagnetic radiation. I shouldn't do this, but I will. I'm indulging myself. So what is the speed of, what is c, the speed of light? 186,282.4 miles per second, or 299,792,458 meters per second. I just wanted to know those numbers. To get back at that guy, I didn't know those numbers. All right, so anyway, relativity. Here's Einstein made a very simple argument here that we can all understand in the special theory of relativity for why time and space, why distance and time aren't the same for two different observers. Let's say that we're standing here by a railroad track. And we're next to the track, and lightning comes over there and over there. Two different lightning strikes. And they strike at the same time. And we go, look! Simultaneity. Same time. But there's somebody on the train, right here, that's passing us, just as these lightning strikes strike, that we see them strike. But this person is moving really rapidly. This is a super fast train. And so what is happening is the lightning strikes there and there, and we say simultaneous, but this person is moving really fast, so they see the lightning, because they moved this way, they see the lightning quicker. It only took 3/4 of a second, not a second, because they moved this way. And the lightning from there has to go further, so they see that one as happening later than this one. So same thing happens, but I say simultaneous, and they say, no, that one happened before that one. Come in. So what relativity says is that consciousness has to be factored into your understanding of the universe. It's a fundamental quality of the universe because it determines what universe you see. So consciousness sneaks into physics through relativity. Does that make sense to people?
No.
You can't. You can't describe the universe unless you describe who's what, the conditions of observation.
That's right.
The universe doesn't sit there. You're going to describe it differently if you're sitting there versus you're sitting here. Time and space are going to be a little different because we're moving relative to one another if I walk. I checked this a lot of times. It's true. Okay.
Yes.
I'll argue with you later, but it is true. So what relativity says is that consciousness, the conditions of observation are part of the description of reality. That is, you gotta factor in consciousness to understand reality. And quantum physics says that there's an inherent uncertainty in nature. That is, even if you know everything that's happened to this point, you can't predict with any certainty what's going to happen in the next point. And in fact, at every point, there's a lot of possibilities, maybe an infinitude of possibilities, and by looking in a certain way, you collapse the waveform so that one of those possibilities becomes reality. So, in order to get a reality, you have to have an observation. So consciousness comes into physics that way because you don't have a universe, a physical universe, unless you talk about who's looking, how looking is happening. So modern physics is, consciousness is sneaking into modern physics as a basic quality of the universe. So what I want to do now is show you. Yeah. I want to show you. Let's see if I can do this with two videos or one video. We can do 10 minutes. Probably we'll do. Well, we'll see. Let's do a little discussion right now, and then we'll see if there's time to do the two videos or only one. So there's a problem here with the auditory thing, which is this thing just pooped out. So I could hand this around, because otherwise you can't hear. So Robert, can you yell? What I don't want to do is argue about physics. I might be wrong, you might be wrong. I don't care about that. Okay, so this go like this.
Is it working? Anyway, nobody understands quantum physics, so I'm not going to go there. But relativity. No, you don't need consciousness. You could have an instrument that doesn't have any consciousness at all, and the numbers would show different for different reference frames. Relativity is basically just geometry. You don't need consciousness for geometry.
It could be argued that those machines are extensions of consciousness. But again, that's a whole other thing. That's a philosophical. Okay, I think let's do this. Have a couple of comments, and you know, let's not worry about the time. Let's have a couple of comments, and then we will see one of the two arguments. Somebody good at this. So,
so who created God, or the transcendental creator?
Yeah, okay, so that's a question that the human mind asks. What happened before? Who created that? That may not be a question that is answerable. That may be something that the human mind has to figure out what caused what. But in fact, there may be no answer to that. When you ask physicists, what happened before the Big Bang? They say there was no before. Time and space came into, you know, it's got to be a before. But that may be the way the human mind works. It has to conceive of time in a certain way. That may not be a valid question. the answer to that, the typical answer to who created God is, nobody created God. God is eternal. God is the one that creates, but God was God was always there. You know, is what people say. So who wants to say? So, like this.
Okay. What existed first, consciousness or the physical world? You mentioned that classical physics think that the physical world created consciousness, and the spiritual is the other way.
Right.
Well, what's true and what's false? Because you have to really decide.
What I'm arguing is there are arguments on both sides, and you don't really have to decide. In fact, I think the people who decide prematurely are dumb. I think that you want to consider all the arguments and kind of hold all the arguments until something evolves in you that creates a certainty. It hasn't for me yet. Who else? Anybody else? Okay, let's listen to somebody who really can talk. Talk about the first disease. This is a scientist talking about consciousness. This scientist is somebody that some of us know about. He actually came to Mind and Supermind about 6 or 7 years ago, courtesy of someone sitting in this room right now. Bob, can I say your name? Bob Weber suggested to us, why don't we get Rupert Sheldrake to come here?
Wow.
And then he said, and I will even enable this by giving some funding for it. And we contacted Rupert Sheldrake. That's a great offer. And we managed to, he just happened to be coming to the United States at the right time. And we talked him into delaying his stay at Esalen so he could come here. He came to Mind Supermind, he came to the New Vic Theater, sold it out real fast. And so I got to meet him and spend time with him, Bob did too. So I gotta tell you about Rupert Sheldrake just the tiniest bit, which is I didn't know what to expect. His reputation is he's kind of a wing nut. He's a scientist, but kind of a heretic scientist. I don't know about that, but he asked me before the presentation, how much time have I got? And I thought he was going to ask me, you know, will 3/4 of an hour be enough? An hour, like some of the Mind Supermind convention centers want to do, you know, they just want to make their money. I said, you know, there's really no time limit. You could go, you know, just, we have to, they'll throw us out of the theater at some point. People typically go an hour with a half an hour for questions, but you could go a little longer if you want. He said, great, I want to go way longer. And he went over to almost 2 hours, and he was totally into what he was presenting. He really was passionate about what he was presenting. And at the end of the when we gave him his applause, a lot of it, he just looked at the audience and he bowed to the audience. He was an absolutely sweet person, remarkable person. Also, in the hour and a half, I guess an hour and a half before the presentation, he met some people one-to-one. I don't remember how they were selected, but some people got to kind of meet him one-to-one. I guess they paid more money or something. I watched him, and he looked each person in the eye, and he totally engaged with each person. He wasn't looking around at all. I had to pull him to get him to go give his talk. He was completely in the moment with each person. I was amazing. I was totally... loved him. He's a remarkable human being. Bob, do you want to say anything?
Benchmark here. You got to go read the Nobel Prize for Physics this year. You want to talk about consciousness interacting with the physical world. Zeilinger was the guy that really deserved it. There were a couple other guys in front of him that were on the right track, but they didn't do a conclusive experiment. It would take a little time to describe what he did, but they looked up the Zeilinger and the Nobel Prize for Physics.
I'll totally go look at it. Thank you. All right, so let's take a look at Rupert Sheldrake talking about consciousness and reality.
About the other Rupert that was up there, Rupert's hero.
Only 11 minutes long. I guess you don't have to see it terribly well. You know what we could do? Let's leave the doors open, but let's close this. So you will see that there are two chords. One of them is the one that makes it. Okay, let's go. Okay. All right.
Could you explain that parapsychism part of this title?
He's got the panpsychic. Okay, here goes. If we close captioning, all right, I'll close captioning, but it's a mixed blessing to close captioning. Okay, here goes. I'm going to play it loud.
Well, I mean, this is the last question. I think consciousness is the realm of possibility. And you can't know about possibilities unless they're in a conscious space. I think minds are containers of possibility. Possibilities are not physical facts. They're just possibilities, and they can only exist in something like an imagination. I think our conscious minds are That's what they do. They're to do with choices and non-possibilities. Our unconscious minds are about habits, things that we just do automatically. We don't need to think about them. And I think all minds really are spaces of possibility, even the mind underlying the cosmos. So I think of minds in general as conscious spaces or realms or containers of possibility.
Are you not on the road there to panpsychism? What do you think of, you know, panpsychism and panpsychists?
Oh, I'm pro-panpsychism. I just think most panpsychists don't go far enough. Most panpsychists talk about the consciousness or minds of electrons or protons or and atoms and things like that.
Okay, so panpsychism, this is a terrible translation. Panpsychism, P-A-N, psychism, means everything is conscious. Okay? Let me back this up a minute. This is as loud as I can get it to go, unfortunately, with this system which they're going to replace. So I guess that this is, okay, let me back up a little bit. So you can, again, he's talking about panpsychism. Let's go back here.
It's really spaces of possibility, even the mind underlying the cosmos. So I think of minds in general as conscious spaces or realms or containers of possibility.
Are you not on the road there to panpsychism? What do you think of, you know, panpsychism and panpsychists?
Oh, I'm pro-panpsychism. I just think most panpsychists don't go far enough. Most panpsychists talk about the consciousness or minds of electrons or protons or and atoms and things like that, which is fine. The reason they do that is because they're trying to explain how we come to be conscious. Standard materialism is the doctrine that matter is unconscious, the whole universe is unconscious. And then they have the problem, okay, but if everything's unconscious and everything's made of matter, including our brains, how come we're conscious? So then they have to say, well, consciousness somehow emerges out of complex arrangements, but how can something totally different from unconscious matter emerge? That's called the hard problem in the philosophy of mind. So to get out of that, some materialists have become panpsychists by saying, okay, well, there's some intermittent consciousness in electrons and atoms and things. So consciousness can emerge from something that has a much, much lower grade of mind or consciousness, even in subatomic particles. And therefore, we can overcome the problem of how something different, it's a difference of degree, not a difference in kind, the emergence of consciousness in human brains. So I think that's fine, I don't have a problem with that, but the question I then asked them is, well, what about the sun? The sun is a self-organizing system. What does the sun think about? What's the mind of the sun like? I think the sun's conscious, and indeed the entire galaxy and the whole universe. So I'm in favor of panpsychism, but pan means everywhere, psyche means mind. I'm in favor of panpsychism, I just think it's much too limiting to confine to the realm of subatomic physics.
So consciousness is not an emergent property of materialism?
Well, emergent property, I mean, what does it mean? It means that something comes from something that wasn't there before. It's a way of conjuring something out of, like a rabbit out of a hat. You see, there are three main ways of thinking about it. One is top-down. The whole universe is conscious, and even before there was any matter, there was consciousness or mind. And the evolution of matter in the universe is the universe has lower and lower levels of consciousness as it evolves. The Big Bang, the entire universe is one system, one mind, as it were. Then the fields of physics and things separate out from stars and galaxies and whatnot. So then you have the emergence of many forms of consciousness, and then on life on Earth, you have, I dare say, in biology, there is an emergence of higher forms of consciousness. I mean, we have more than a worm or a bacterium. So in that area, then you could say that there is a kind of emergence. But the top-down consciousness means you start with consciousness and it goes down from above, as it were. The bottom-up materialist theory is you start from subatomic particles and atoms, and and you work your way up, and then you have say, well, it emerges. But you could just as well say it descends. And the third position is to say, well, it's both. There's a sense in which there's an emergence or an appearance of higher levels of complexity with more complexity. But it's not that it was not there before. And after all, our evolution has happened within, on the planet Earth, within a galaxy. And what if the whole galaxy and what if the whole solar system are conscious? And what if Gaia, the Earth, is conscious? Then our consciousness has appeared within much larger conscious systems. So, you know, these are philosophically different ways of looking at it. There's a prejudice in modern science in favor of materialism and reductionism and bottom-up explanations. But that's really a kind of philosophical fashion, it's not the truth.
How long is it in the fashion and how much further do you think it's going to
go? Well, it's been the fashion since the late 19th century. Science became dominated by materialism in the late 19th century. And in many ways, our views of matter have changed since then. They had an old classical physics view of matter as little atoms, as little billiard balls. Quantum theory changes that very radically. They didn't know about the galaxies beyond our own, or the Big Bang, or modern cosmology. So all these things have changed, but the philosophy of materialism is sort of locked in a 19th century worldview. And of course, you can have an updated materialism. In a sense, panpsychists are trying to update materialism, but as soon as you admit psyche or mind into matter, then it's not really materialism, it's really a form of animism. Animism is the belief that all of nature is alive and the whole universe is like an organism, not a machine. I think that's a much more reasonable view myself. So what we're at the moment in is a kind of conflict between old-style materialism and the kind of animism or panpsychism struggling to get out. And so far it's only got as far as atoms and molecules. But one reason I like to ask panpsychists about the consciousness of the sun is that I think they're on a slippery slope, and I'd like to push them down it a bit faster than they go on their own. Discussing the consciousness of the sun is a very good way of accelerating the slide down the slippery slope into a full-blown animism.
It seems to me like there's what's the basic definition of consciousness then? Or what is this thing that materialists and average
Well, I mean, there's hundreds of definitions, but it's to do with awareness, and as I said, to start with possibility. That's my own definition, it's about the realm of possibility. They would say it's about perception, awareness, algorithms in the brain. You know, as soon as you get into modern cognitive neuroscience, then the brain is a computer, consciousness is just the software programs running it. But they, of course, needn't be conscious. You know, they're not conscious. So, in the materialist philosophy of mind, consciousness is either an epiphenomenon that does nothing, like a kind of shadow of physical activity in the brain that has no role, and there's no free will, doesn't actually do anything. That's the majority view. Or else, it's an illusion produced by brains, because it might have some conceivable evolutionary advantage, but it still doesn't do anything. The problem is that to call consciousness an illusion doesn't explain it, it presupposes it, because illusion is itself a mode of consciousness. So philosophers of mind in the materialist school go round and round in circles, like dogs chasing their tails, trying to explain it, never succeed, and anyone who comes up with a theory, another one will point out the flaws, and they come up with their own, and the other one will point out the flaws in it. And that's why it's called, the very existence of consciousness is called the hard problem.
It seems to me more of a major part of that is just the limitations of language, of words, how can we describe them? The hard problem is, will show many things, but one of it is just how limited English or language is describing
I don't think the problem of consciousness is a problem of language. I mean, language itself, of course, is a product of consciousness. And language is inadequate to explain many things, including the ultimate nature of reality, the beginning of the universe, and so forth. But I don't think that the problem is with language. I think the problem is with worldviews. And do you have a worldview that's essentially an atheist, materialist worldview? There is no God, there is no consciousness out there. The universe is unconscious. It's purposeless, meaningless. Everything's happened by chance or accident. The laws of nature have no particular reason to be one way or the other. We just live in the universe where they happen to be right for us. Evolution is a matter of blind chance mutations and blind natural selection. That's a worldview that says that consciousness has just emerged in our brains and doesn't actually do anything. Also that we don't have free will. A deeply depressing worldview, and I think that when you have whole societies based on it like ours, what you predict is that lots of people would suffer from depression, and the facts actually bear that out. If you think you live in a meaningless world where your mind is just in your brain and it's nothing more than what's happening inside your head, not truly related to anything else, deeply depressing. Whereas if you think consciousness is primary, that we live in a universe that's purposeful, that our minds are part of something much greater than ourselves, that mystical experiences connect us with greater minds than our own, and not just serotonin levels changing inside our brains, then you have a completely different view of the universe. It's not just a matter of language.
For more debates, talks, and interviews, subscribe today to the Institute Art and Ideas at IAI TV.
So let's see if there's any comment about that, and I'll tell you that next week I will play the other one shortly after we begin class. The other one is a talk by Murray Gell-Mann, who's one of the 20th century's greatest physicists. He's the guy that theorized quarks, the smallest subatomic particles that have been identified at this point. And his talk he has a gorgeous talk that argues exactly against what Rupert is saying. So, is there a comment, any comment or question on what we just heard? Bernie, let me, you go like this, okay? You have horizontal.
Did you get
I don't want to sound silly, but what does it really matter if we believe one way or the other? If we believe that it comes from bottom up, it comes from top down, I don't understand where it makes my life.
For some folks, it doesn't matter at all. You're just kind of living your life, right? But I think for two reasons it matters. One reason is because some of us kind of you just have a curiosity about what is the nature of reality. And secondly, when difficult stuff happens, when bad stuff happens, if you think, well, you know, that's just the way things are, it's kind of tougher to take than when you think that there might be some lesson behind this. It might not be so bad. There might be something good in this. And the ultimate of that is when you're getting ready to pass from this world. You know, if you feel like this is kind of the final, you know, there's nothing else, then it's harder to do that than if you feel like you're part of a larger process. You're just making a phase transition rather than a complete exit. Abraham. And I guess there's one more, which is when you walk around in your life throughout the day, if you feel that there's meaning and purpose, it tends to make you happier than if you feel like things are just happening randomly.
You know, since humanity started, we're trying to answer three questions. Who are we? Where did we come from? And where are we going? In doing so, we get to answer the question of consciousness, physical world, understanding the difference between them, and understanding our spirituality. And it matters. It matters to know whether science created consciousness or the other way around. So we've been asking these questions for eons of years. And we still do, and we haven't found the answer.
No, but the pursuit of the answer is driving a great deal of progress, a great deal of enrichment of consciousness.
Like this?
Yeah.
So, two things. It's the pursuit that you're saying, because I don't know if we will ever have an answer, and will we know we have the answer when we have the answer? What is the proof or whatever, how we know the answer? So it's the pursuit that exercises our mind and keeps us busy thinking about things, because I really don't know if we will know when we have the answer. Or everyone will know. Right?
Agreed. Wait, I should do this. I should be doing this. Hang on. Should do this after each person. Yeah. I'm supposed to do this after each person. So who else? Who else would like to talk? Okay.
Expanding on why does it matter? I was thinking that you touched upon it, the conceit, that most of us are trapped in our egos most of the time, and always thinking in terms of myself or what's going to enhance my ego or what is threatening my ego. So going beyond the ego and identifying with something bigger than ourselves, which religions try to do or people in all ways, to be able to step back, realize what comes from the ego in all our interactions and speech, and identifying with that which is greater than us, which I think is consciousness. And so I think the ego plays a big thing in our understanding.
So that's very well said. I remember something that Rick Tarnas used to say. He used to say, as the Western mind has developed, our conception of who we are has shrunk to, at the extreme, at the modern extreme, we're a separate individual with a separate mind, basically different or separate from everything else. And so our sense of self is this little circle down here in a great big universe. He said it used to be that our conception of ourselves was a huge circle that was almost, if not equivalent to the whole universe, certainly much larger part of it. So as we have become individual, an individual culture rather than a collective culture, we have come to feel worse and worse, smaller and smaller, more and more isolated. And so the effort to reconnect, to understand what's beyond ourselves, is an effort to make us feel better and feel larger, be more, feel like we're more a part of things than apart from things.
I really enjoy the quandary of trying to figure it all out, because I get to the point of impossibility, and then I can reflect on my in-the-moment experience of the life force within me and the connectivity that I have with everything and that's happening in an unfolding way.
I agree that too much time spent in the left hemisphere of our brain exclusively is not the best way to navigate life. Right. So I think it's time to leave. Okay, next week, okay, if this was a little bit abstruse for you, or a little bit ethereal for you, next week is going to be equally ethereal, but in a much more practical way. I think next week I'm going to present to you a general theory of psychology after we listen to Murray Gell-Mann. So next week we talk about psychology. This week we talk about everything. See you later.